Hello and welcome to the ELT Under the Covers podcast. Today, our next guest is a freelance writer, teacher trainer, consultant specialising in digital publishing, online course development and the development of digital resources for teachers. Since 1992, he's worked all over the world as a teacher, trainer and project manager. He was the global head of learning for Macmillan's online English learning school, English Up, from 2014 to 2016. In 2016, he won his second British Council Award for Innovations and co-founded Peachy Publications Limited. Welcome to the show, the digital guru, Nick Peachy.
Thanks very much. Thanks for that. I'm not sure about the digital guru. In a way, I kind of keep trying to throw that off a little bit, and kind of widen my spectrum of appeal. But, you know, it comes back at me. It's like a boomerang. You know?
But, you know, we live in a... I can't believe I just started a phrase with "we live in a world." We live in a world where it's becoming more and more relevant and more integrated within education. So it's maybe not necessarily a bad thing. But before we kind of get into that and maybe what you're doing now to broaden what you're doing, can we dial it back and go all the way back to the beginning of kind of like how you started getting into teaching, and if you could give us your origin story?
Well, it all started in prison. it did start in prison. I was a music student, and I studied music, and started getting into teaching just to sort of get through my degree and not have to borrow too much money. And my next door neighbour did art therapy in a prison, and she said they were looking for a guitar teacher in the prison. So I thought, okay, you know, it was, you know, comparatively then really well paid. And I thought, oh, I'll give that a try. So I went along to the prison once each week in the evening and did blues guitar classes for prisoners, for a group of prisoners.
How was that?
That was extraordinary. it was extraordinary. Some interesting classroom management kind of problems and things like that, which I'm not really supposed to speak about. I think when I went in, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act to say that I wouldn't sort of talk about what happened there. But, you know.
There
is a story that I have about students exchanging chocolate biscuits for drugs and, you know, in my class, and that was a difficult thing to deal with. You know, but
sorry, when was this, Nick?
This was back in the early 1990s. Nice. Early 1990s. Okay. I was still in college then, but it was an interesting experience, and it was interesting for a lot of reasons. It's interesting from the sort of the development as a teacher, because I'd never taught anything before. Mm-hmm. And it was quite interesting sort of from the perspective of the impact that education has on people and how you can see that, you know, most of the guys who were in the prison were really no different from me or a lot of the other people that I knew. But, you know, for some reason that they stood out a bit, and, you know, they'd sort of fallen into bad ways, mainly because of lack of education, and, you know, and that you really started to see that, you know, they weren't bad people or anything like that. They were just people who'd had a, you know, who'd drawn a short stick, really. And that had sort of quite an impact on me. And I think that still sticks with me today, I think.
It's really, I hear this repeatedly, and there's a publisher, I can't remember the name, but I believe one of their books actually got turned into a movie, Meg. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that, but that book was actually write books for prisoners where basically they do graded readers for mm-hmm. adults and for basically kind of young men, because the majority of prisoners are mm-hmm. men, with their interests in mind in order to, you know, raise their reading level and education level. And I can't remember the statistics off the top of my head, but it was a significant percentage of those people that had were able to raise their education on reading, but specifically reading level, greatly reduced their reoffending time. So
I can believe
you know, like what you were doing there would give them maybe skills, but also confidence that they can learn, basically.
Yeah. As a that might not have happened in my case, because as a teacher, I wasn't a particularly good teacher. I didn't really, you know, but it kind of, you know, you always feel that, well, anybody who knows about something can teach. But, you know, one of the things that I learned from that is you really need to know how to teach. It's not just, you know, I could play the guitar, but, you know, knowing how to teach the guitar is a very different thing. It's like the same thing that we have in the English language field of, you know, being able to speak the language doesn't mean you can teach the language. It's a very different thing.
Well, I'll tell you what comes to mind there, Nick, is the sort of the university lecturers and professors and the way that many of them teach. You know, we've talked about this before, and there just does seem to be this idea that, you know, what you're paying for there is expertise, not necessarily pedagogy.
Yeah.
There are some good ones, but... Yeah. They certainly seem to be the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, I mean, that was another interesting thing for me, actually, because I was actually a mature student. I kind of left school at 17 and ended up being a cleaner and doing odd jobs and building work and things like that. And at some point in my life, I thought, you know, I don't want to spend the rest of my life like this. And so I started playing the guitar and got back into college to do a kind of degree in music. And after that, you know, I wanted to do composition. And so I thought, well, I hadn't got any money. So I decided to become an ELT teacher, go to Japan and make some money to do my master's in composition. Oh. Pretty bizarre plan on reflection, you know, thinking that I'd make some money from ELT. but, you know, when I went to do my CELTA course, you know, the teachers, my trainers, I thought, what fantastic. And I felt it was amazing. And I thought, you know, this is why I've never felt that I could learn anything. You know, I didn't have teachers like these. You know, I've been used to sort of, you know, when I did my music foundation course, you know, the guy who lectured us would come in with his book of Groves music and his notes from the last 20 years and just kind of read bits of the book to us. And we were supposed to sort of make notes and then sort of know that stuff. And, you know, I always felt, well, you know, why don't you just give us the notes that are in your book that you're reading from? And then we're done, aren't we? You know, but, so it was the first time I realized, you know, how bad some teaching could be and what good teaching looked like as well. So that, for me, that it made a huge impact on me. You know, I really enjoyed teaching English language students. I did my CELTA in Cairo. I was working with refugees and it was just fantastic. And just sort of being with people, you know, especially after, as a musician, you spend a lot of time alone practicing your scales and stuff like that, you know, actually being with a group of people was kind of nice. It was, you know, it had that performance aspect as well, which was quite nice. So, and I really enjoyed it and got into it. And I think probably the world hasn't missed, you know, one less jazz guitarist. So, you know, that's probably the world, a good decision.
Well, I wouldn't have imagined that, sort of a music style career would be the obvious path into ELT. However, I don't know if you know this, but when we spoke to Jamie Keddy, he said that he started as a pianist on a cruise ship, and then it was after injuring his hand that he got into English teaching.
Yeah. You'd be surprised how many people get into it who come from a performing arts background. You know, I found a lots of people who have been actors or have been writers or, you know, musicians, and especially kind of the kind of native speaker ones like myself who knocked around the world a bit. You know, there were quite a few people like that who'd come from something else and who were still doing something else as well. Because it is, you know, it is quite a nice profession to be in that way. There is the performance aspect. It can be incredibly creative, and, you know, you get to work with people and you get that kind of the kind of feedback of an audience in a way, you know, which is really nice too, and in a really nice way too.
Well, it's a big component of it, and I think it's something that the more academic side of ELT don't really acknowledge as much, because I guess it's a more of a soft skill, so you can't teach it. But you know, like there's people out there that don't have any pedagogy, don't have any CELTA, that just go to, you know, China or Vietnam or whatever country and just turn up in a classroom, but yet everyone loves them because, you know, they can play the guitar and they're entertaining. It's just, you know, the kids aren't learning anything really. So yeah, there's definitely a component, and the teachers that do well tend to be those that can combine both. And on your point of a jazz guitarist in the classroom, I think that, you know, Scott Thornberry might argue that Dogme is basically ELT jazz. So
yeah, improvisation for sure. And, yeah. and I think, you know, there are parallels as well between learning music and learning language, in that, you know, you have form and structure, and you improvise within that. You know, you have kind of genres of conversation, if you like. Yeah. You have genres of text for sure. And, you know, and you still have to work within that, within defined structures, and improvise within that. You know, conversation isn't prescripted, is it? You know, you have to work with the language that you have. You're not just regurgitating chunks of language. You're actually working creatively with them to sort of, you know, reinterpret meaning and negotiate meaning with people. So I think, you know, the music side of it and the jazz side of it is, I think, very relevant.
How do you see music? I mean, because for me, I kind of put a lot of these, and this is my fairy brain talking, I put a lot of these language, music, art under the umbrella of communication. Do you feel like when you're playing music that you are trying to communicate in a way, or is it more kind of you're just being expressive? Well, that's kind of communication. I don't know. What? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess it's a mixture of both. In some ways, you're trying to communicate. And in some ways, you know, it's communication with yourself as well. You know, I feel like, you know, when I spend a lot of time playing on my own and alone, and for me, it's a kind of, it's an escape. It's kind of a meditation. You know, you can, it consumes your mind, and you can sort of not think about anything else for a while, and that's kind of nice. But performance, in a way, is more when you come to perform, it's sort of a lot about communication and, you know, kind of distilling that and conveying that, isn't it? You know, because if you listen to music, you know, you're looking for it to communicate to you, aren't you, really?
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for something that speaks to you.
Yeah, be it actually with the lyrics, with intention from the music and the artist. Sometimes it's not with intention, it just speaks to you and, you know, just gets you dancing, and there's no kind of, it's just kind of fluff. Okay, so we've talked about your first getting started, and currently you're traveling the world, you're going to all these different countries teaching. When did you kind of start to take it to the next level, per se?
I guess moved around through a few countries for 5 or 6 years. I'd done my Delta, and I moved to Barcelona, and I started working at International House Barcelona and got into CELTA training there. At the time, when I first moved there, it's funny mentioning Scott Thornberry, I had to take over classes from Scott Thornberry.
Oh,
and I was
God.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah, okay, I can do that. No problem. So I had to go and observe a couple of his classes and then take over the classes from him. And, you know, which was, in a way, was great. And it's great to be sort of knocking around a school where people like that were. You know, Scott Thornberry was there. Gavin Dudney, who's sort of another technology guru, was there. Graham Stanley was working there at the time. You know, lots of people connected with educational technology and teacher training were there. And I managed to get into CELTA training there, which was kind of a good move. And I started doing my master's while I was there as well. I did a master's in educational technology through Manchester University. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of quite interesting because at the time, this was about 97, I think. At the time, I knew nothing about technology in educational technology. I just bought a laptop and had to get someone to help me connect it to the internet, and which I think was Gavin Dudney, actually. And decided to, some guy turned up to, who was one of the teacher trainers, said he was doing a master's in educational technology. And I thought, oh, that sounded really interesting. Don't know anything about that. I'll give it a try, kind of thing. And,
yeah.
And that's what I did and really enjoyed it. You know?
That's awesome. That's interesting. And this works with, this kind of relates to my background as well, because I did media production, university. So my question is, how do you find, you did your master's with educational technology, did you find that useful now with the education we have now? Because I found that my degrees very fast, very quickly became not based on the technology I was used to at all.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I did my master's through distance learning. Mm-hmm. And it took me 5 years, 4 or 5 years, I think, to complete it. Mm-hmm. And the technology within that space of time changed pretty rapidly.
Wow.
You know, I'd just finished my Delta, which I'd done distance as well. And I'd done that. They used to post these yellow packs of photocopied books to you each month. And you'd then fax in your assignment kind of thing. You know, I was faxing in my assignments from Singapore. And then you go to this sort of master's degree and, you know, we had an online community and stuff like that. But like you say, the technology was moving pretty quickly. And, you know, it was kind of, in those days, it was pre-Flash. And we were learning how to do HTML code to code a page, you know, writing every single letter of the code out by hand and stuff like that. But I think, you know, the good thing about doing it distance and doing it over a longer period of time is that you develop as an autonomous learner, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's, you know, for me, that was what I really got from it, this ability to learn autonomously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the thing that sort of helped me develop my career, because, you know, if I just stopped learning about technology when I finished my master's, I would be totally irrelevant now, you know, because most of that stuff is just, it's just history, you know. But by the end of, I think by the time I finished my MA, you know, you could just about, you know, watch a live streamed video and it would be about this big on your screen. And, you know, I can remember the first video I watched that was live streamed, it was Beyonce. It was a Beyonce music video. And it was just so blurred, you're kind of thinking, is that Beyonce over there or is that Beyonce? No, that's the curtains. That's Beyonce. You know, you could just about distinguish it. But so things are coming, you know, being able to do things like this is huge. And that's sort of come about over such a short amount of time. It's just, you know, mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling. And it's mind-boggling that it's not like it's stopped now, you know? It kind of feels like everyone's saying, well, we're at the peak. And we are at the peak, but we're at the peak riding a giant wave. And we just, looking back, you kind of go, this is crazy how fast this has changed. And then you've got to extrapolate from that and push it forward and go, well, what's it going to be next? But I kind of want to return back to your story before we dive into something more like that. So you've done your master's, you've got all these qualifications, you're feeling more of an autonomous learner. What's happening now at this point? Is this when you start to get into Peachy Publications or?
Not at that point, no. I started getting pulled out of teaching and more into project management.
Oh.
I got a job in 2003 working for the British Council, managing the British Council's Teaching English website, which then was just starting up. So I started sort of managing that and getting into sort of teacher development through technology and things like that. So I did that for about 4 years. and learned an awful lot from that. And then about 2007, you know, I decided to sort of go freelance and go into freelance educational technology, doing training. And I was blogging then and a bit of materials writing and stuff like that.
Okay.
And that was kind of a big step, and you know, going from the security of a job with a civil service pension to sort of going freelance, and also as the manager of the within the British Council, you know, I was sort of flying around to conferences all over the world, you know, presenting the website at the time and trying to get people on board for it and stuff like that. And so, you know, you're met there and you're the guy from the British Council. So it's like, oh, yeah, you feel like this VIP and you're treated really nicely.
You're not just the guy from British Council. You're the manager of the website that's, you know, suddenly is becoming more and more and more relevant every year. And what drugs did you take to make you quit that?
I don't know. You know, I felt like I was sort of stuck in a rut of doing the same things. Okay. And, you know, I applied for something, you know, which would have been a step up and didn't get it, and sort of felt, well, you know, if I really want to move on, you know, I have to start doing it for myself. And, you know, I saw, you know, we were hiring in these consultants to sort of, you know, tell us stuff about technology, you know, that I already knew. And I thought, oh, I could be one of those guys, you know.
Right.
So I decided to sort of leave and go into consultancy work and things like that, which has been great. It's had its ups and downs and, you know, and scary moments. And there's moments when they've gotten so scary where I had to get a job and then I've gone back to being freelance again. But, you know, it's an interesting route, that's for sure.
But you're liking it right now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I still have my worrying months when, you know, you're cruising along, you've got too much work, you know, and all of a sudden the work comes to an end and you think, oh, I've got nothing. You know, I better go and find some work again. Yeah. You know, write some more books or something like that. I mean, the Peachy Publications side of it and the writing, you know, my own books and publishing them really helps a lot with that, because, you know, that's a bit of a cushion for when, you know, when you come up to that gap where you've suddenly got no work, you know, I can always put work into that and write some more books, write some more lesson plans. And although that doesn't pay off immediately, you know, in the long run, those things bring money back. And so that's a kind of good thing, really, to...
It seems like you're really into infographics at the moment.
Yeah, I've been into infographics for quite a while. Infographics have been one of my sort of, you know, pet loves. It's just, you know, it's a really nice form of media that's very user friendly for the computer screen. You know, it's much easier to get, especially language students who don't have high language levels. It's easier to get them reading through an infographic that has sort of lots of visual support, vocabulary rich, information rich, than it is to get them, you know, reading a black and white text off the screen or something like that. So I find them really useful for that.
Yeah. It makes sense. You know, we're so visual, and it helps process. And there seems to be like a thing with humans where we like it in a visual form. I've just been researching about Richard Feynman, with his Feynman diagrams and stuff, and that revolutionized physics, right? So, you know, maybe infographics will, I wonder how they will be used within the classroom, maybe just for homework, I don't know.
I like how they can stimulate conversation, because I've actually used a few of Nick's infographics. In fact, I was using one today about the, oh God, you know, when you can't remember something you did five
years. Yeah, it's had a big impact on you, hasn't it? No, but it'll come.
It was the Habits of Billionaires. It was the 10 Habits of Billionaires.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it's not like presenting this stuff and saying, you know, well, this is all well-researched and is definitely true. It's more like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, do you think this is true? And stuff like
that. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's always, you know, I think it's one of the things that is a theme through my work is, you know, provoking students' opinions about stuff. It's not a point of, you know, giving them a text or giving them something and saying, do you understand it? No, it should be a point of giving them a text or something and do you agree with it? You know, do you believe it? Mm. You know, what do you make of that? And so that there's a much more personal response. I think too much of the ELT materials are designed with comprehension of what we believe are the key facts or the key ideas, rather than, you know, what how it matches into the student's life, what they're going to do with it, you know, what they feel about it, what they think about it. You know, and that's where really learning takes place, is when you start, you know, pulling it into your life and thinking, what am I going to do about this? You know?
Mm-hmm. So how do you go about creating and finding these you know, packets of information or what have you? What do you look for when you're about to create these infographics or, you know, your lessons or what have you?
For the infographics, I generally find them online, and you know, it might be sort of a theme that's kind of popular at the time. Like NFTs NFTs are a big thing at the moment, aren't they? Non-fungible. I can't remember what the T is. Tokens. That's right. So I thought, oh, I'll have a look for an infographic about it. And I found a few infographics about that and started writing a lesson plan about it, you know, because that's something that's sort of quite thematic. Sometimes I just find them and think, wow, that's really useful information, or that's really interesting, and start building a lesson that way. With some of the, I'm writing a course called Conversation and Listening, which started off as materials for English speaking clubs and to get people speaking. And for those, you know, I actually write scripts and commission audios for them. And for those, you know, rather than sort of setting out to get students to understand them, I try to sort of develop comprehension activities that get students to compare their lives with the person that they're listening to, so that they're kind of looking for some element of common ground. Where's the commonality with this person? How does their experience match onto my experience? That kind of thing. And, you know, because I think that's, you know, that's where learning takes place, is sort of having an emotional connection with something.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
In a way, it's a bit like the music, isn't it, as well? You know, if you listen to the music and you have no emotional connection to it, it just doesn't stick with you, does it?
It needs to resonate. Yeah. It needs to resonate. And there are deeper, more universal themes that, you know, if someone in America or, you know, in Korea makes music, you know, it might be in a different language, but, you know, the sounds, the melody might connect with you, and everyone else can feel that sadness or that happiness or what have you.
Yeah.
I think what's a little bit ironic, I suppose, about the importance of interest and engagement in the classroom is I don't think I've actually come across anyone recently anyway who doesn't admit that, who doesn't say, you know, if someone's going to learn, so if you want a class to go well and someone to learn something well and easily and all the rest of it, like, interest is the paramount thing. It's the most important thing. And nonetheless, this message does not seem to transmit into the mainstream.
Yeah. Everybody says, yeah, it's about interest. It's about engagement. It's about, but what's the grammar point? Yeah, what's the grammar point? How many vocabulary words are they're going to learn? I've had a real problem with this, actually, in terms of, you know, trying to sell the materials, because, you know, at some points I've talked to, you know, schools or people who are running courses and, you know, wanting them to sort of take the materials and use it as a course, you know, and often that's what they say. Where's the grammar syllabus, and or, you know, how many vocabulary words are they going to learn? What's the vocabulary they're going to learn from this? And, you know, I've tried to write the material so that they're very student-centered. And so, well, the vocabulary they're going to learn is whatever they need in the lesson or whatever they come up with between themselves, or, you know, and, the, you know, a similar thing from the grammar as well. But that's, you know, it's a very hard thing to sell because, you know, we're so used to, you know, going to that contents list and, well, yeah, go, okay, today we're doing the present perfect, let's go, you know.
So why do you think that is? I mean, I'll give you a couple of my thoughts first and let's see what chimes. But one of my thoughts were always with institutions, specifically more academies that I'm thinking of more business-wise, they focus on the materials more because I feel like they don't trust the skill of the teachers in a way. Like they, you know, they just see teachers, especially, you know, like in language academies, that are businesses, they know the teachers are going to come, they're going to come and go, you know, maybe every year or whatever. So as long as the material is good, they know they can present that to the parents, or whoever, and say, this is what you're going to be learning. So it's almost kind of like the teacher's not really needed, or they're just kind of there to kind of just facilitate it, like they're added on. So it's, they're not, the teacher isn't of importance, when you kind of need a skilled teacher to be able to make it student-centered.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of my thoughts, but, you know, why do you kind of come across it?
I think there are different elements, and it is to some extent, you know, it is the lack of appreciation of the teacher to some extent. Also, a lot of the schools that I've worked in, you know, it's about marketing. And so, you know, and the marketing department doesn't really understand what goes on in the classroom. So what they see as marketable is, well, we're marketing this certificate, or we're marketing, you know, this chunk of language that this person will learn. They don't really understand that actually the product, you know, what your students are paying for isn't the certificate, it's actually the teacher and the time spent with the teacher. And I think this was really, you know, I worked for an online school for a couple of years as head of learning. And, you know, what we found was, you know, what students really valued most when we did all our sort of market research about, you know, we gave them their course materials, we gave them their autonomous course materials, but what they really wanted was time with the teacher. You know, that's what they valued and that's what they perceived themselves as paying for. And yet it's very hard, it seems very difficult for sort of the marketing departments in a lot of schools to understand that and appreciate that you know, really, that's what the, I mean, it sounds horrible to say that the teacher is the product, but time with the teacher is the product. Yeah. You know, that's what students really perceive themselves as buying. You know,
but certainly how do we argue that it should be more student-centered? Shouldn't it then be more teacher-centered if they're paying for to be with a teacher?
Because that teacher, that person, you know what I mean? Is the person who's able to understand what you need, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, going to the doctor. If you go to the doctor, you know, it's about, you know, the doctor talking to you and giving you what you need. It's not about the medicine, because you get that at the chemist, you know. It's the knowledge of the doctor, I think. And I think, you know, the other big problem is actually testing and assessment and certificates, you know, is that, you know, a lot of the teaching ends up having to, and coursebook writing has to be geared towards a sort of specific course, because there's this certificate at the end and they're being assessed for this, you know, and that's a huge, big money business. And so, you know, coursebooks tend to be geared towards that. We'll get you through IELTS, or we'll get you through FCE or something like that.
Yeah, I could teach kids or earn, you know, an okay amount, or I could teach to test. I could teach to, you know, pass IELTS or Cambridge first certificate and make a little bit more bank. So, yeah. What's best for the learner? I'm just going to leave that hanging.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, we do live in a world where...
You did it. We live in a world.
These certificates are... Indeed. You know, this certificates are necessary for many students, aren't they? Particularly things like IELTS and Cambridge English, if, particularly if they want to study abroad or whatever. And that's not going to change anytime soon, as we can talk about the pros and cons.
We like to put people in exams, boxes, but... and then we bury them.
I would change the word necessary for required, though. They're required by students. Students are required to have them, you know, even to the extent where, to some extent, you know, they would prefer to acquire that certificate by some method than actually put the work into actually learning the language and being able to speak the language. You know, what they need is to speak the language, but what they're required to produce is the certificate, isn't it? So,
yeah, no, and they don't always go in tandem.
No, they don't at all. No. Not at all.
And it's a point now that's, I think, with autonomous learning becoming more and more prevalent, that accreditation, it is important, because it's like the shorthand that tells the employer that you're skilled. Because right now there's a lot of people going out there saying that they're experts in, you know, such and such, and there's no real kind of way to prove that you're an expert in, for example, being a social media manager, apart from being able to produce statistics. But even those statistics can be skewed or might not be a good representation of how skilled that you are, i.e. kind of like doing the IELTS or something like that. It's almost just a rough approximation. So I wonder how online schools are going to deal with that going forward.
Well, I think, you know, there's a big sort of issue around, you know, capability and links to certification and things like that generally throughout, you know, education, as technology starts to move so quickly and technology impacts on everybody's job.
Yeah.
You know, so increasingly your degree or your certificate or whatever it is and whatever it's in, you know, the older it is, the less valid it is, unless Very you true. Can, you know, unless you can prove that you're somebody who's able to keep up. And maybe, you know, somebody who hasn't got that degree increasingly is becoming more employable if they can show that they have the skills, if they're doing what's necessary and can sort of think and work independently to produce that. Those are the kind of people that a lot of employers are looking for now, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's...
I would totally agree with that. And yeah, I think there'll be a lot of circling round to kind of see how we can kind of update the education system to be, I don't know, more fast paced, able to assess someone's skills quicker in order to kind of show some certification or accreditation to make it easier for employers. I mean, how have you found it? Because where you first started doing this, you know, we were talking about, you know, HTML coding, you know, bit by bit, and a little live stream of Beyonce, and now it's everywhere, and it's so ingrained, and suddenly with the pandemic, everyone was forced into it. From your perspective, how was that, you know, for kind of teachers and yourself?
For myself, it's been, you know, on a kind of purely personal and selfish level, it's been quite good, you know, because, you know, these are things that I've been doing for quite a while, and it's really great. You know, I mean, the pandemic, don't get me wrong, the pandemic is an awful thing, and it's, you know, if there's one good thing that's come out of it, it's the sort of push within education to get teachers engaging with and students engaging with technology, you know. And what I've seen as well is, you know, some, especially among younger teachers, there's been a real kind of development of engagement with technology and entrepreneurship from younger teachers. You know, loads of teachers now producing their TikTok and Instagram lessons and things like that, which is marvelous. You know, it's just fantastic, and really using social media effectively, becoming, you know, independent producers of media. And I think, you know, the range of what's available to the students now through different social media and through technology is much wider, and I think that's really good, a really good thing.
Yeah, we talked with Teacher Little Mary who's a YouTube teacher a couple of a month or so ago, and you know, she's doing exactly what you were talking. You know, she's currently taking her master's in technology and language learning, but also teaching online. But you know, whereas you have your books, she focuses on social media, on YouTube to kind of supplement her income. And it kind of seems like a lot of tools have been put into teachers' hands for ways to kind of move away from institutions in a way and kind of become more self-employed in a way.
Yeah, and I saw recently there's a nice site set up as a teacher collective and a cooperative as well, you know, teachers getting together to sort of form their own businesses. You know, I think that's called My Cool Class, I think, just to give them a push. And, you know, which I think is a really good thing. You know, teacher cooperatives is a great idea, I think. You know, because it is difficult to do everything on your own. You know, if you've got to teach, you've got to be the marketing person, you've got to make sure the money comes in, you've got to make sure the bills get paid, you know, and your invoices get sent out. It's a lot to deal with. But so, you know, the idea of sort of teacher cooperatives, I think, is a really nice idea. And, you know, teachers working together to sort of achieve things is great.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a lot easier for let's just say the younger, more digital native teachers, but then we've got older generation, maybe not so digitally savvy teachers colliding with this new education technology being, you know, online and blah, 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 blah. But what have your experiences been with those teachers? You know, what do you have them coming to you going, what do I do?
I mean one of the things that's come out of it for me is a lot of training work and things like that, which is nice. But you know, I think, you know, a lot of older teachers have been pushed to sort of engage with it. And, you know, in some cases, people, you know, if they're really willing to and they're still open-minded enough, you know, can engage with the technology and can see how to use it and are willing to do that. I mean, I know there are lots of people who long for the classroom and for whom this isn't human for them and stuff like that. And those probably those people will start going back to the classroom quite rapidly. But, you know, whatever, even when they do, I think they'll take something valuable from this experience with them. You know, I think it's, you know, teaching online is a really valuable experience. It's valuable to see yourself and how you communicate, because, you know, most teachers standing around in the classroom can't see themselves. But, you know, I'm here now in Zoom and I can see myself. And, you know, actually, when I teach and I do my sessions, I kind of teach standing up so I can and get a bit further back so I can, because I use my hands a lot, and so I do it like that. But I'm in a chair for this today because I'm trying out a new desk. But but I think it's good to see yourself and see what your body language is like and see how well you're communicating. It's good to have, you know, the chat, that kind of back channel that goes on in your classroom anyway when students are passing each other's other notes and sort of see how you can use that. I mean, most teachers have had a go with a few digital tools and they'll probably take something of that back to the physical classroom with them. So, you know, I think, you know, there are very few losers in this, in terms of education, at least. You know, again, the pandemic's a terrible thing, but in terms of education, I think there are few losers. In some case, I think the losers probably would be the students who have had to endure the teachers while they learn how to use the technology, or those that haven't got access to it, which is, you know, the really big issue, I think.
That's true. That it's I'm not even sure it, yeah, maybe we could say that it's a wealth gap. It's definitely a technology gap. We've been talking about teachers, maybe certain teachers being not very tech savvy, but then, you know, there's the students' side of it as well, especially with the young learners, where you know, if they don't have a parent around and they don't know as well, that it's going to be incredibly difficult for them. So there's barriers with it as well. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And of course, there are, you know, in some parts of the world, you know, a whole family's internet access might come through one phone, you know, so, you know, who's going to be using the phone at this particular time? Or, you know, can you borrow your father's phone so that you can have your lesson, kind of thing? You know, it can be very difficult. And, you know, we have to think about sort of designing learning with those contexts in mind too. You know, and some of the projects that I work on or have worked on have been sort of, you know, engaging with in that those kind of scenarios as well.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because one of the things that Richard and I try to focus on and bring with our channel, our podcast, is that the English language teaching, the industry and the pedagogy and all the methodology that we have, we're in a unique position because we don't just, you know, teach within our native country, but we teach in different countries with whole different levels of access to education and means as well. So, you know, like, you know, we might be teaching in a university in the UK where we've got access to everything, but then suddenly we're in, you know, like a rural village in China where we've just got a chalkboard. So there's a whole array of skills that I'm sure that you found as you're traveling around, where you kind of go, you're adaptive, you're dynamic to be able to flip from high technology to low technology. And I think there's a lot that our industry can bring to the broader education. Just broader education. You know, what do you kind of see the ELT industry to be able to help, not just with, you know, like teaching English, but education as a whole?
I mean, I think there are things to be learned from English language teaching, particularly from communicative methodology. And you know, I think in a lot of ways, English language teachers were kind of ahead of the curve in terms of methodology and pedagogy, in terms of sort of communicative language teaching and getting students to engage and things like that. Although, you know, if you're a lecturer who just stands there and talks, then this kind of medium is kind of quite easy for you, isn't it? You know, in a lot of ways, it was much more challenging for some people who were used to sort of saying, well, get into pairs and do this, or get into groups and do this. You know, that became much more difficult. But I think, you know, certainly for me, because a lot of the work I do nowadays is outside of English language teaching. It's, you know, it's also soft skills. It could be finance, business, lots of different things. And, you know, what I've taken from, you know, what I've learned and the methodology that I've had through English language teaching has been really, really valuable, I think, and enabled me to teach those or design materials for those other fields in a much better way.
So is that basically you're focusing on making it more student-centered with the materials and stuff that you produce outside of ELT?
Yeah, I think more student-centered and more student-to-student interactions and things like that, rather than, you know, this kind of lecture-centric kind of approach that a lot of topics have.
What do you have any thoughts about autonomous learning, kind of how to teach that? Because, you know, you developed it, you developed autonomous learning yourself. When you're trying to espouse that, or you kind of get other students to do that, because, you know, you could go online and you could look at all these MOOCs or YouTube and listen to lectures, but then you still have to learn. When people come to you, what do you say about the best way to go about doing that?
Well, I've done quite a lot of work with teachers on autonomous teacher development, and sort of encouraging teachers to, you know, get involved in social media, getting involved in teacher communities. And, you know, I have a kind of a session that I do, which shows a kind of cycle of how I do it myself. You know, you get embedded in a community, you ask questions, you find articles, you find the right people to follow, you read articles, you curate them and organize them. Maybe you blog about what you do so that there's some reflection on what you're reading. You try it out in the classroom and you write about it and get feedback. It becomes a kind of continuous loop, I think, within sort of social media, of this sort of finding information, processing it, seeing how you can apply it, reflecting on it, sharing it with other people, getting comments on it. You know, I find I'm in this continuous kind of feedback and experimentation loop of learning.
I think that's fantastic. You've put a lot of things into words there that I've been thinking about lately. Yeah. It definitely, there's a lot of learning comes from community, and that community almost acts as kind of like the teacher component where you could ask questions and get guidance.
That's right, yeah. And you know, and pushing that into the kind of materials that you produce for students, you know, getting them to get involved in communities and do research to check information and then produce something based on what they've discovered and share that, you can sort of push them to do the same kinds of things. Mm. You know, project work, for example, if you're taking a PBL approach, project-based learning approach, then, you know, that's developing a lot of those kind of autonomous learning skills. And I think that's really valuable. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting. Did you have anything to add, Rich?
Well, there's quite a lot of things, actually, that we could sort of go into. I think that one of the big things is is reflection and thinking about all of these different things and how they fit together, and encouraging teachers to do that and providing an environment where teachers are able to do that, because we do have a lot of things that are seemingly contradictory, don't we? Like, we want to build up student autonomy, but we recognize the value of a teacher. When you said that, actually, when you spoke about the value of a teacher, it made me think about, there was a time about 15 years ago when I really got into MOOCs, you know, online courses. And this website called Coursera had just started up, and there was a load of really interesting courses on there. And I think the website's still going, but it's a little bit different to the way it used to be. It's kind of saturated with courses now, but back then there weren't too many, and a lot of them were very interesting. They were from very kind of big institutions. So I did a whole load of different courses on a variety of topics, because, you know, I find everything sort of interesting. So I did like this course on astrobiology and the search for life on other planets. It was very interesting, by a professor from Edinburgh University. And I did this course on an introduction to programming, and it wasn't just about, you know, Java or whatever. It was a whole range of different programming languages, so I found that interesting. And Brief History of Humankind, which later was made into famous book, Sapiens, which came out. And, you know, I think pretty much everyone's heard of that and or read it now. And I did the MOOC about 15 years ago with, what's the fellow's name? Yuval Noah. No. I always forget his name.
Harari.
Anyway. Whole load of different topics, all of them interesting to me. And I did all these different courses. And what I found was that the most critical element in determining how much effort I put into that course, and also whether it stuck with me, was the lecturer. It wasn't the subject. So yeah. Some of the lecturers were really engaging. There's a fellow called Dan O'Reilly, and he did a course called Irrational Behavior. And he was using a lot of the kind of pedagogical techniques we use in ELT. Like, before he would do one of his little mini videos on something, he would say, oh, so we did this experiment where we had this and we had this. What do you think happened? Who do you think, for example, earned more money? Or who do you think was more successful? You know, and then this pop-up box would come up, and you had to type what you thought. And then the video would continue, right? And that kind of stuff was great. You know, it was obviously that he was driving this kind of interactive pedagogy, and he was a very kind of interesting and dynamic lecturer in general. And that really highlighted to me the importance of the educator. And I think that language teaching, especially in the kind of 90s, as communicative language teaching sort of all come together, the 80s, the 90s, the CELTA and everything, I think there was a big shift away from that as we kind of went, right, it's going to be all student-centric and let's get rid of TTT and, you know, the teacher should be sort of almost squirreled away in a corner while everything happens in the classroom. It was almost like the ultimate aim there was to take the teacher out of the equation as much as possible. I remember with they even structured it like that, okay, you might start off with teacher to students type interaction, but at the end you want it to be students to students, right? And I think it was almost like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And when I did my CELTA, I didn't really recognize that. I was just being told these things like, no, you know, avoid TTT and you want to make it really student centric and all the rest of it. And something about it felt off, but I didn't have the experience to be able to verbalize that or challenge it. But I think today I would challenge it. And I would say there's definitely, there's more of a balance to be had there. We need to recognize the importance of what the teacher can bring. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's kind of an interesting one to think of what exactly that is, because it isn't just knowledge. No, it's not just about the teacher's knowledge. It's also about, you know, it's also about the way that the kind of teacher can motivate you and make you feel, you know, it's your relationship with the teacher. And it is kind of interesting when we think, because there's a lot of talk now about robot teachers and, you know, and how robots can artificially create what looks like a face being sympathetic or something like that, and sort of they can simulate empathy, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder whether that will have the same impact on the student if they know that isn't a real person. If your robot is programmed to feel empathy for you, will you still feel motivated by that? No, or do you have to know that it's a real person relationship?
Would we even need a robot? Would it be more like a virtual avatar? And then would we even know if it's a virtual avatar? You know, like, because we deal with chatbots right now. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know a lot of the times that it's a chatbot, but sometimes when they pop up and they just start talking at you, you're like, there's two clicks sometimes of you going, oh wait, this is not a real person, and then then you switch off, right? It's interesting, and I think there's a deeper conversation there as to how it's going to look in the future for teachers. But I think we're looking to wrap up now, right? You've got to be somewhere.
I'll have to leave in a few minutes to pick up my daughter from school.
Okay, so
from that very traditional school that hasn't changed in hundreds and hundreds of years.
Do you ever go into the school or go to parents' evenings and you just go, just keep it together, Nick. It together.
When I walk into school, I'm just some old man with a beard and a hat on who's coming to pick up a little girl, and that's as much as they know, and that's fine.
Little do they know.
Don't sort of burst into a nearby classroom.
Well,
what are you doing?
You know, I have, particularly for primary school, you know, I feel that, you know, I have very low expectations of what I want from them. You know, I want my daughter to go there, be happy and enjoy her time learning.
Yeah.
You know, I think if that's happening, then probably the rest is going to come. You know, okay, she in a way she has a privileged background in that both her parents are educationalists and there are God knows how many digital devices knocking around in her house. But if she goes there, she's happy and she enjoys learning, then, you know, I'm happy too. That's good. I wouldn't want to interfere with that.
I think that's really what we can basically do as teachers. and it's what I found when I was teaching in China, was the thing that I could, I might not be able to get them to, you know, speak English fluently with my one class every 2 weeks, but I could get them to really enjoy my class and love learning. And if they can take away that from school, then, you know, they will be autonomous later on in life. That would be my hope. So Nick, could you let our viewers, our listeners know how to get in touch with you, what you're working on now, and we'll put all of this below in the comments in the description, but give us a rundown, please.
I guess, you know, my main project at the moment is Peachy Publications, where I produce the materials that, you know, follow on from my values and my philosophy of education, if you like. Mm-hmm. They can get that within what's called a teacher's classroom app, which contains the whole library of materials if they want to, or they can buy individual ones. That's sort of my main project. I'm still on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and things like that. So I share things there with the community that I think will be useful. Mm-hmm. And I guess I also curate materials and articles through Scoop.it. I've got a website called Tools for Teachers and Learners, where I've curated about 1,500 tools over the last 10 or 12 years.
Wow.
And a similar one for articles, where where I've been collecting articles that I find interesting connected with education and technology. And you know, I'll give you links to share for those as well. So, but, you know, I just sort of focus on keeping learning and trying to keep things moving forward and paying the mortgage when I can.
Very good. Yeah, I would personally recommend Nick's LinkedIn feed. I think it's at the very least thought provoking, if not has the occasional teaching gem in there. So
yeah. Check out the comments and the description for the video and for this audio podcast, and you'll be able to get all the links to what he's just mentioned. Big thanks to coming on the show, Nick. It's been a really interesting conversation, and we love your work.
Great, thanks. Always nice to have a chat with people.
Yeah,
and get to do that very
in this
often.
Day and age, especially so. Yeah.
It's me and a 7-year-old most of the time. Okay, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
If you're looking for more information from myself, you can go to teamteacherchina.com. We've got a whole bunch of materials, PowerPoints that you can use instantly in the classroom. We've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we have videos teaching you how to use those materials. Team Teacher English, where we put those materials into a video form for self-study. And Team Teacher Baby, where I take my experience as a teacher and put that into parenting.
And go to YouTube.com / Professor Rich to see some English teaching. You can catch me weekly live streams on Oxford Online English YouTube channel. Oh, and also you can do a YouTube search for POG space UK and you would get my alpha version of my new gaming channel, which actually just have some trial content on there at the moment. You can email us here at eltunderthecovers@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show.
Smash that like button, share and subscribe.
And watch 100% of the video and don't click off. Thank you.
Bye.